You won't find banks or post offices open today, though many state and local offices are open. It is Columbus Day, or Indigenous Peoples Day, if you prefer, honoring the people who Christopher Columbus, quote unquote, discovered on his journey from Spain in 1492. Their lives changed greatly over the next few centuries, and not for the better, and there are certainly still impacts. Extractive industries still put great pressure on Indigenous people the world over. Our next guest has witnessed that pressure and how it is expressed in the Americas. James Phillips is an affiliate professor at Southern Oregon University of Anthropology and Sociology. He is the author of a book called Honduras in Dangerous Times and has spent plenty of time, particularly in Central America, looking at the impacts on people who live in that region. Thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Morning, Jeffrey.
Good to have you here. So you actually have some Indigenous ancestors yourself, is that right?
Yeah, through my grandmother and great-grandmother, I'm descendant of Innu people. The Innu are the first people of Quebec, the Indigenous people of Quebec, who have been there for thousands of years. And in recent years, we know have suffered a lot through because of aluminum mining in the area and NATO bases and a number of other things. And they have been reduced, and forced to live in settlements, communities, permanent communities. And their life, traditional lifestyle, is much more nomadic. In the winters, they used to roam around Quebec during the winter.
Wow.
And live in Quebec
in
the winter.
Very cold place in the winter.
Yes. And they would dress lightly and keep moving, basically. That's what they did. And in the summers, they come down to the St. Lawrence River and the rivers and stay there for a few weeks, months. So, but they have been reduced. And today, because of the destruction of their culture and reduction of their communities, they suffer a lot of what we'd call social pathologies, high suicide rates, sniffing glue among teens, all kinds of, alcoholism, self-destructive behaviors, which is a result in large part of what happens to people when their ways of life and culture and everything that has meaning for them is suddenly destroyed, taken away, or forcibly changed, and we get very disoriented, especially the young people. So it's part of my ancestry, and, there are still 8 or 10,000 Innu people in Quebec today.
Did knowledge of that ancestry propel you into the work you've done with your life, or did it sort of come the other way around? You did the work first and then found out the ancestry.
It's funny. I knew from my grandmother that she had this ancestry. We were there. But I didn't think a lot of it because it was, and I also grew up with the European ancestors, so I'm one of those many people who has this mixed ancestry. But then I got into anthropology and began to think about Native peoples a lot more and study them a little bit more. But what really propelled it was I came back to it some years later while I was teaching, at a university, went to the library, pulled out a book that found the book about the Innu. It's a journal written by an anthropologist who'd spent a winter with them in Quebec, and fascinating, and I started reading portions of it. I knew that it was some of my ancestors. I started reading portions of it to my wife, Lucy, and she said, "That sounds like you." And I said, "I said, really?" And she said, "Yep, just like you. Your attitudes toward how you raise children, toward, a lot of things." And it wasn't so much the physical, the culture, but it was the attitudes and the thoughts and the value system that people have, And I thought, we're still influenced by our ancestors, even in ways that we don't realize, by
things that have never been communicated verbally.
Yes, right, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that got me much more interested, and I started reading about it and found a couple of colleagues in Canada and the U.S. who are doing research with the Innu, and that propelled me into it. But the problem with studying this for me is it's very painful history, and I can only deal with it a little bit. All of this history is painful for Indigenous peoples, mm-hmm. But when it's your own ancestors, it's even closer, and you feel particularly difficult for me to study it.
So is it somewhat easier then to cover the plight of people in Honduras, for example? I mean, because you have at least that level of removal emotionally.
It would be, except that when you start, the occupational hazard of people like anthropologists is that you start, objectively, so-called, looking at people and, studying them or whatever, and you discover that you relate to them somehow. They become friends and acquaintances. Good friends, colleagues, so you begin to develop relationships, and then after a while you realize that you're not at all, that their lives are important to you, in ways that go beyond, just studying them, what happens to them. And I want to point out, by the way, that what happens to people, to indigenous peoples in places like Central America and other parts of the world is really, you know, affects us in many ways as well. And so we'll maybe talk about that in a bit too.
Well, sure. I mean, right now, I mean, how is it, you know, if people are being oppressed or removed off their lands for resource extraction, how does that affect the rest of us?
In several ways. In Central America, for example, let's take Honduras in particular. In Honduras, there's a... Honduras is about 7-8% of the population is indigenous people. It's a country of about 9 million people now. It's got 7 or 8% of it, I don't know how many hundred thousand indigenous people. One of the groups, one of the sizable groups there are the Tolopanes. The Tolopanes live in the center of the country, very rugged mountainous area in the department of Yoro. And they are... they've been fighting for years against a mining operation in the area, particularly a community, one of the communities, the local Mapa, a little small community. And there, they're fighting an antimony mine, a mine that's going to be mining antimony. Honduras has a lot of material, metals that have been mined for many years, going back to the 1870s. But in the past 10, 15 years, there have been hundreds of government concessions to mining companies. About 30% of the country is now under concession to
mining. Does the government need the money that badly?
Is that part government of the wants the money. The thing about the government in Honduras is that a lot of that money, concessions, they sell the concessions, and then there's a lot of corruption. Officials pocket a lot of that money, too.
All right. The fate of the Tulipanes and other indigenous people in the face of resource extraction in Central America, as witnessed firsthand by James Phillips. We'll come back and talk more with him on the Jefferson Exchange, and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join in. Jim will be talking this afternoon at 3 at the Stevenson Union Rogue River Room on the Southern Oregon University campus about Earth Protectors, indigenous solidarity with the Earth, North and South. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about Indigenous Peoples Day, which is the other version of Columbus Day, if you don't particularly want to honor Columbus and the legacy that he left on the Western world when he began heading westward from Spain in 1492. A couple of segments. We're starting with James Phillips, who's an affiliate professor of anthropology and sociology at Southern Oregon University, the author of a book called Honduras and Dangerous Times, where he has witnessed firsthand pressures on indigenous groups because of resource extraction and the desire to get the things that they live near or on top of or under out from around them, and often involves a fair amount of disruption, as you might have heard over the course of history. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we're talking about Honduras and the Tulipanes and the mining of antimony. Which, thank you for the reminder that it's not pronounced antimony, which I thought it was for probably 30 years. The government wants the money that it can get from leasing the land, and so I imagine it's not providing much help to the Tulipanes.
It provides, the government gives concessions to companies, both Honduran and foreign companies. Canada has the largest number of concessions, Canadian companies, but the U.S. and others as well. And those concessions bring money into the government, but, you know, the politicians pocket quite a lot of that for themselves. The thing about the Tulipanes is that there's maybe, the numbers differ, there may be 8 or 10,000, maybe fewer of them, but they're in many different little communities. And the community of Loco Mapa, in a very mountainous area, was fighting a mining company wanting to mine antimony. And they set up a little roadblock. This is what indigenous people do to keep the trucks out, to keep the mining people out. They're also protecting large stands of, up in the mountains, stands of mahogany, precious mahogany, which they do not want to log. They want to keep that for posterity, for the future, which I think is a very wise thing. But they set up a roadblock about 2-3 years ago now, I think it was, something like that. And there were some people that were at the roadblock all the time. That's what they do. One Sunday afternoon, 5 p.m., down the road came a truck with 2 or 3 guys with guns, employees of the mining company. Everybody identified them as that. Came out. They had been drinking, and they started shooting at people who were there. They killed 3 people at the, you know, 3 local people, Tolopanes in Locomapa. My wife was one of the people who accompanied the bodies, took them down to the morgue. I don't know why, because and brought them back and found caskets for them, and she stayed with the community where they had the wake. But that's just one of many examples of so many examples of how this is dangerous. But the point about this is that antimony is not just one of these wild, strange, you know, things on the periodic table. Antimony is used for things like cell phones, etc. So when I'm saying that, you know, in many, many ways, the fruit we eat, the cell phones we use, a lot of the metals we use, you know, are mined in places like Honduras. And the mining of these things requires, you know, the destruction of whole areas, sometimes the destruction of rivers, water supplies. To mine, the estimate that I've gotten from Honduran geologists is that the an average gold mine, say, which they also mine gold, an average mine like that in Honduras would use more water in a day than a rural community would use in a year or more, several years.
So as consumers, we are sometimes the unwitting beneficiaries of yes. pressure upon indigenous groups, because the things that have been extracted to help make our consumer products came from areas where people were shoved off the land.
Yeah, fruit, you know, and it's also agricultural products as well. Plantations move people out of the way. So when people get pushed out, the communities get pushed out, and it's not just a gentle little push, it's, you know, violent sometimes. Many people have been killed in countries like Honduras, Guatemala, for defending their land. The army is sometimes, or police is sometimes used to help remove people. They destroy communities. They do it quite roughly, violently. People get killed. Now, the classic tale of this is the tale of the Lenca people, who are another people in Honduras. They're one of the larger groups. They're, I don't know, 120,000, something like that. The Lenca live in the western part of Honduras. They have been fighting for many years against the damming of their sacred river, the Gualcarque River. And we're familiar with dams in this area.
Yes.
and the conflicts that go on around dams, you know. But there, the damming of their river, what happened is that the government gave concessions to a Chinese company to build hydroelectric dams on their river, a series of rivers actually in that area. And so the Lenca people are pretty well organized. They've been there a long, long time before the Spaniards. And they have their own organization, and the acronym is COPIN. It's the Civic Council of Indigenous Peoples of Honduras, or something like that, close. And their leader at the time has been Berta Cáceres, a young woman who, a Lenca woman. They organized resistance to these damming projects. And I was there. It's an area, one of the areas, Rio Blanco in the western part of the country. And I was there. I visited there along with a group of people from Ashland here. We went, my wife and I took them to that area.
I want to give your wife credit by name, because she's a known commodity. Lucy Edwards is the former news director here
right.
at JPR.
Mm-hmm. And she's been involved in Honduras also for years. But we took the small group from local church here. We went off to see at Rio Blanco. It's a difficult ride to get there, you know. And the people were there, manning. They have a little, very simple barricade across the road. The road was built without any permission, without any okay from the people. It's their traditional land that it's on. But the mining company, I mean, the hydroelectric company, bulldozed the road through without any permission at all. But what they did was set up a roadblock so that the mining, the company could not send through its trucks. You know, the company had built a compound right on the edge of the river where they were going to stage all their materials and everything to build a dam. So the Lenca people would, from the start of that road where they had put up their little roadblock, and they met it day and night. There were people there day and night, Lenca people. They set up a system of resistance there. They just set up the roadblock. They wouldn't let any trucks through except local traffic. And then they started about six, seven months of almost daily processions walking down the road to the compound, to the river, and standing in front of that compound and facing the soldiers who were defending it for the company. You know, we don't, it's interesting that, you know, the army would defend, you know, a company's property. But that's what they do in Honduras. So the people were standing there, and in one of these trips one day in August of, what year was that, a few years ago, one of the protesters, peaceful protesters, was shot and killed by the army, soldier in the army, and Berta Cáceres was the leader of the Kofkopan and the Lenca resistance, Lenca people. She was accused of inciting violence, and she was accused of, the Lenca themselves were accused of trespassing, which is an absurd, if you think about it, trespassing on your own land sounds absurd, but that's what happens. And so what happens is the victims are accused of the crime. So this is a classic example. So Berta Cáceres led this struggle for years, and she kept getting death threats. She reported 33 death threats to the police, the local police. They ignored all of them. The international Inter-American Commission on Human Rights ordered the Honduran government, they have the authority to do this, they mandated the Honduran government to provide protective measures for Berta Cáceres to ensure that her safety. She's a human rights and environmental indigenous leader, and so she was a target of people who wanted to kill her in order to stop this, you know, the resistance to the dam, because the company claims it's losing a lot of money, you know, every day, they can't build this, et cetera, et cetera. The government is frustrated because they can't get the dam built. And the dam would have, this series of dams is going to provide hydroelectric power, and that power is used primarily for mining. So it's a double.
So not necessarily going to the households
So here we have what's billed as clean energy, hydroelectric power, being used for some very dirty industrial work, and that clean energy displaces communities. So what happened with Berta Cáceres is that after all these 33 threats against her life, she was finally assassinated one night, and they are now in the process of trying to find out, you know, they've charged a few people, which is very unusual in Honduras. But the case was so big and so international that they had to do that. The reason why it's big and international is because she had won the Goldman Prize, the Goldman Award, which was awarded to every year to just a few native indigenous leaders around the world, environmental leaders, and she had won this a few years ago. And the following year, she was assassinated. The other thing about her that's interesting is that when Pope Francis wrote his big letter on the environment, he admitted that he had been influenced by Berta Cáceres, which is interesting to me that this indigenous woman, this Lenca indigenous woman environmentalist from Honduras had influenced the Pope in his views on. And the view was, basically, the message is, we treat the people and the environment the same way. If you see the environment as disposable and throw away and use up, you treat the people the same way. It's one ecology.
which is what James Phillips has been studying for a good bit of his life. He is an affiliate professor of anthropology and sociology at Southern Oregon University, author of a book called Honduras in Dangerous Times. He'll be giving a talk this afternoon in honor of Indigenous Peoples Day on the Southern Oregon University campus called Earth Protectors, Indigenous Solidarity with the Earth, North and South. That's at 3 o'clock this afternoon at the Stevenson Union Rogue River Room on the SOU campus. You can join the conversation now on the exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You know, we have essentially 500 years plus of record, like what we're talking about here, where people who have lived peacefully on the land for thousands of years find that they are living on or over or under something that is wanted as a resource by the rest of the world, and that resource, somebody wants to come in and extract it, and it usually involves pushing the people out of the way. Do people like in positions of power in Honduras, do the governments, do the utility companies, the mining companies see themselves in that way, or do they see themselves apart from that?
I'm not sure. They do rationalize it. So, you know, there are international laws, you know, come around to this question, because I have to point out that there are international laws and, you know, national laws. Honduras is a signatory to both the United Nations, you know, declarations about the rights of indigenous people, and also the International Labor Organization, which is a branch of the United Nations, the ILO Convention 169, which is specifically on the rights of indigenous people. And in that convention, they talk about, and hit the phrases that they use is, the right to free, prior, and informed consent on when government or a company wants to, you know, use an area, mine it, or dam the river, do whatever, they are required by law to consult with the local community. This is not just indigenous people, but any local community. They give them free, prior, and by free, what free means is uncoerced consent. Free prior consent before they start, uncoerced, and if the people say no, we don't want the project, then they don't do it. That's the law, but it's always violated.
And so, how much success has the UN
not much
permanent forum on indigenous issues and other non-UN type organizations had in applying some pressure here?
Not much. They can do, you know, international. What really helps is international solidarity or international, you know, to have people observing this outside of, you know, Honduras does put some pressure on the government and on the companies. And one of the things that happens is if there's enough resistance in Honduras, peaceful resistance and delay and, you know, legal procedures that the local people can mount, the indigenous people or international organizations can support them in. The companies, the investors, the mining companies, the hydroelectric companies, sometimes get cold feet because, you know, you don't want to invest in a situation that's going to be iffy. So they sometimes succeed in getting the investors to pull out, which is one of the few weapons they really have to protect themselves.
It's economic pressure of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So does any of the displacement in particular come from good intentions? I mean, are there good intentions? I mean, people who think, well, they'd be happier if they had clothing and they had permanent houses and things like that.
Yeah. I'm sorry to laugh, but it's an example of this is what happened with the Tulipanes when, you know, the mining company came to them and said, the example I gave you before, the mining company came to the communities and said, well, you know, we want to mine here, and what we'll do, we'll create jobs for you. We will build bridges, you know, because those rivers are very difficult. You know, the rivers are hard to cross. We'll build you nice bridges. We'll build some health centers, you know. We'll build all these nice things for this very poor community, you know. So they were going to do this, and they said, we'll do all these things for you. And the reply that the Tulipanes gave them was, yeah, but you're going to kill us in the process. You're going to destroy our water. You're going to take our land. We won't be able to live here. So what good are bridges and hospitals and, you know, schools for us if we're all dead or gone? You know, it's not. And the other thing about these things is that all of these extractive industries, when you displace people from their traditional self-reliant communities, these are people who can feed themselves, who can, you know, farm. They don't depend on a lot of other people. You take that away from them and turn them into dependents. And the whole process turns indigenous people into dependents of the state, dependents of foreign companies, takes their dignity, their spiritual life, their identity away from them as independent people. And this is really at the core of a lot of the problem. It's not just a material problem. It's a question of identity and, you know, spirit. And because it destroys community and it, destroys the lives of people. And
is there a basic cultural misunderstanding, Jim Phillips, about what is poverty? What is subsistence? I mean, do we have different definitions, and therefore, just as cultures can't figure out what looks horrible to us might be quite okay?
Well, I think, you know, some of the discussion about, there's some interesting books written about this question about development and poverty, you know, and one of the criticisms of development, I mean, we need to have development. Obviously, governments need to have an income. We need to have the materials that we use for our lives, et cetera. So the question is not stopping this stuff, but the question is how to do it in a reasonable way, how to do it in a way that's fair, that's open, that is free, prior, and informed, you know, all of that. How to do it in a way that benefits everybody and doesn't destroy the environment. And this requires a lot of creativity. And unfortunately, I don't think we've given enough both creativity to that, you know, a thought about it. And we have to apply political pressure to this as well, because it's not going to stop by itself.
All right. Indigenous people, again, are still ending up in the pathway of quote-unquote progress as people attempt to extract timber or minerals or metals or water or any one of a number of different commodities from out from under or over or between indigenous people around the world. Jim Phillips has witnessed this firsthand in Honduras. His book is called Honduras in Dangerous Times. He is a professor at Southern Oregon University and will be speaking about Earth Protectors, Indigenous Solidarity with the Earth, North and South this afternoon at 3 at the Stevenson Union Rogue River Room on the Southern Oregon University campus. Jim Phillips, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thanks, Jeff.
Good to see you.